Inside the Film Pod.
Alrighty, thanks for joining us inside the Film Pod. I'm Adam Filmy Film, and with me is Edgar
Taco Ram Jam.
Taco Ram Jam. I just realized that works.
Yeah, Taco Ram Jam.
And Ram Jam.
Before you ask, I am doing well.
Well, this week's episode is not exactly one movie specifically, but more devoted to a director.
Darren Aronofsky.
I don't know how it's pronounced. Aaron of Sky, yes. Yeah. Actually, it'd be Aaron of Sky, because it's not two
said,
A's.
Aaron
yeah.
of Sky.
Yeah. Because it's only one A. Although it's almost Aaron, but yeah.
Okay. But
it's devoted to him. We are looking at four films, and not the one you think. We're going to look at his two earliest films and his two latest films, and skip that one in the middle, because the one in the middle we're talking about is Requiem for a Dream, and obviously that if you're like an Aaron of Sky film, fan, you're going to be like, hey, if you're going to do a thing about him, that's the movie you're going to talk about. Well, we're going to skip that because that movie is basically Darren Aronofsky's like magnum opus, and so it's also just famous in general, and so that's going to get its own entire episode. So like, if you're a fan of that movie, we're not, setting it aside, but we're not forgetting about it. It's going to get its whole own episode.
Exactly. But this week, what we'll be reviewing will be Black Swan, The Wrestler, Pi, and The Fountain.
And, well, we're not exactly going to review them. We're going to basically reminisce and stuff. And so I'm going to go ahead and say, spoiler warning, we're going to spoil all four of those films so we can talk about them in depth, all that jazz.
So I hope you guys are all ready.
Yeah. But first, we're going to go straight into the news because we're going to be talking about a lot of films and we don't want to waste time. Isn't that right, Edgar?
Movies!
News.
Sundance Film Festival, still happening and stuff, movies winning awards, that we won't see for a long time, there may be an office, spin-off, wait, people still watch that, and on the box office front, people pay big money to see Leon Neeson punch wolves.
So yeah, Office may get a spin-off involving, I think it's Dwight.
Could be called
the only, like, the most interesting character from it, because... Didn't Steve Carell, he left it, right? He left the show?
I think so.
I actually stopped watching it after, like, the first four episodes. Not that I didn't like it or anything. It's just I didn't have Netflix at the time. Well, it wouldn't be on Netflix anyway. I don't know. I just don't keep up with TV very well. Like, it needs to be on DVD or something for me to get to it. Because, I just can't... You can't expect me to come in every week at the same time. I have a life, man. I got to fit it to my schedule.
And me, I never watched the show. I could never take it because I really don't like Steve Carell.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, there's good Steve Carell and there's bad Steve Carell. And The Office was like a mix of both. And I don't know. I think a lot of times he worked.
I don't know. It's that whole thing that I saw a few movies that I enjoyed him in. But I enjoy him in more small bit roles.
Yeah, like Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah.
He was great in that. But
I haven't seen that whole movie.
Oh.
But I saw like The 40-Year-Old Virgin. I watched it when I was a teenager, but I didn't really watch it for his performance. I watched the unrated version for a purposeful reason.
Wow.
You're
a teenager. We'll let that slide.
Okay. But I watched, like, Dinner for Schmucks and...
See, I like that. Surprisingly... Well, I liked Steve Carell in that movie. I didn't really like the movie that much. You know who else is in Dinner for Schmucks?
Who?
Zach Galifianakis!
Oh, yes.
Yes. I just love saying Galifianakis. It's just got all the syllables I need, all the syllables I want in a word, you know?
Yeah.
Say it.
Galifianakis.
There you go. Doesn't that just make you feel better on the inside?
Oh, yes. No.
Don't enjoy it too much, Edgar.
Okay.
All right, what were you saying? Dinner for Schmucks, you don't like it.
No, I didn't enjoy the movie.
I'm just kidding. Go on.
No, I just didn't enjoy the movie because it was just boring for me. I knew the comedy, and it was just nothing too special. He has what I consider, and I put with Russell Brand, who try to be funny, and at times they are successful at it, but for the most part, it just like gets a small smile out of me, and I just leave.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the way he acts.
Yeah, or, like I said, there's good and bad Steve Carell for me. Yeah.
Like
I'll definitely say that I don't enjoy him more than I do enjoy him. Like, there's more stupid stuff he does than good stuff.
Like, I mean, I would love to see him in a dramatic role just to actually understand him. Like, I want to watch Little Miss Sunshine. It looks like a movie he's actually good in.
Yeah.
But it's like, if Maybe even Get Smart, because that looks like his type of comedy.
No, that looks terrible.
It looked better than his competition, The Love Guru.
What? Wait.
The competition.
It doesn't matter if it's better than his competition. The poop better than other, you know, that poop shinier than the other poop. Both poop. That'll make it better.
Well, I don't know. I heard good things of it.
I don't know.
And there's, like I said, there are certain comedies that I can imagine him being good in, but I want to see him in more of a dramatic role, because for me to think of a good actor, they have to be diverse. Like, we had this conversation off the mic with Johnny Depp, how he might not have done anything that's super memorable.
But no, he's done memorable things. Well, you mean he hasn't done anything like Oscar-worthy or like outstanding performances? No. He's good in that. He hasn't really demonstrated like super great acting, but yeah, what we were saying is he's an incredibly diverse guy, and like it's like he's underappreciated and or overappreciated, and like I don't know, it's either like you love him or hate him, and to me it's like he's just all right. Like, he's really diverse and he can do a lot of stuff, but he hasn't done anything like outstanding.
But see, as I was defending him in this conversation, that's what I like about him. It's he's willing to do something that seems fun.
Yeah.
He's not the kind of guy who's like, oh, that's going to get me an Oscar, I'll get the role. Mm-hmm. He's like, that looks like a fun role. I mean, why else would you take the role of playing Raoul Duke in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, or Jack Sparrow in
Pirates
of the Caribbean?
Or Ed Wood. In Ed Wood. I think that's, it's called Ed Wood.
Yes, it's called Ed Wood. Or Edward Scissorhands in Edward Scissorhands, and so on and so forth, because he has such a diverse
resume. Tim Burton and Ed. What's with that? Or maybe Edward Scissorhands is named after Ed Wood.
Maybe. Could be. Well, no, he's not a tranny. No, he's not. He's a crossdresser, all right?
Yeah.
Ed Wood is known as a crossdresser. That's why he made the movie Glenn and Glenda.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it's Glenn or Glenda. Not and. Not that matters. I could probably be wrong anyway, but
it doesn't make
that matter. No one cares about Glenn or Glenda. You know what we care about? Plan Goddamn 9. And, like, I love Ed Wood. We're going to get to that movie, so I shouldn't talk about it too much, but I'll just say I loved how that movie, like, went. Because, like, you know about Plan 9, you go, well, you don't, not necessarily everybody
knows. Most
people
probably don't
even
remember it.
But as, like, a nerd, I know about Plan 9. And Ed Wood, that's his most famous movie, is Plan 9 from Outer Space. And, like, the way the movie's constructed, like, I thought they weren't going to get to it, but then they do, and you're like, yes! And, like, Ed Wood, or Johnny Depp, when he's watching Plan 9, he's like, yep, this is the one I'll be remembered for. And you're just like, yeah, Plan 9! It's okay. So great. And I don't remember the guy's name, but the guy who plays Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood, I think he won an award for it. I don't know. Or he was either nominated or...
The guy who played Bela Lugosi?
Yeah.
I think so. I think he won,
was like, Best Actor nominated for it. Or, I mean, Supporting Actor.
Yeah. But before we... Like I said, I won't say anything about it. I will say a few things about Ed Wood. One, look him up, because I'm not going to give you the details of his oeuvre, but I will say that towards the end of his career, all he did was do porn.
Really?
Yes.
They didn't go into that in the Tim Burton movie.
Yeah. He just did porn for the last year. That's
sad.
That just shows you how his directing went.
Well, yeah, Ed Wood is like... He's famous because he made really bad films and somehow was able to get them made. And the big thing is he got Bela Lugosi to work with him.
That was the other thing I was
saying. Was goddamn Dracula and, you know, an actually, like, famous actor. But, yeah.
Didn't he die during mid-production of Plan 9?
He actually... I don't know how accurate Ed Wood is, but according to Tim Burton's movie, he died before the movie was made.
Like,
before they even shot the movie. Like, they shot some stuff.
Yeah.
And Ed Wood used that for Plan 9. I don't know exactly how accurate that is.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
Okay. That sounds right. You know, details, whatever.
No, but that's what I was going to say. He used Dracula. And it's a thing. It shows you Bela Lugosi, how he went through his career as well. If you compare him to his competition at the time, Boris Karloff.
Boris Karloff, which is discussed a lot in Ed Wood. Like, yeah. Bela Lugosi hates Karloff. It's so hilarious.
Which is funny, because their children actually became best of friends.
Really?
Yeah. But, like, we'll talk about it some other time. We'll review that film on its own. But do you have anything else to say?
No.
No, but see, Ed Wood might have been known for his worst movies, but Darren Aronofsky is not. And
What worst movies?
Well, he's known for some of the worst movies ever.
Aronofsky?
No.
No, I'm just saying Aronofsky doesn't have any bad movies.
Debatable. No, Ed Wood is known for having just a whole oeuvre of bad films.
Well, yeah, that's all he's done. But
Darren Aronofsky isn't.
Are you trying to segue, Edgar?
Yes.
I'm going to stop you from segueing. Oh. We had a different segue going. What was the segue we had planned?
I forgot.
I don't remember. Okay, I guess we should get into it because we're going to be talking about four whole chunk-a-lunk films. And those chunk-a-lunk films are Pi. Oh, we said this already in the beginning, didn't we?
Fountain.
Pi, Fountain, Wrestler, Black Swan. All by Darren Aronofsky. Fun fact, Aronofsky. That name makes me think of like some like extravagant European man, but he's not.
Nope,
when I saw the picture, yeah, just when you think Darren Aronofsky, think Darren. He's just some guy named Darren. Like, he's just this pasty, almost chubby, but not fat, just like normalish, chubbyish white guy with a mustache. His name's Darren.
Good director, though.
Great director. And yeah, we should talk about that guy about now.
Well, first film I want to get into, because I think we should go in reverse chronological order, is
Black Swan.
Black Swan, which, for those of you who don't know, was released in 2010.
Come on, you gotta know that.
It was nominated.
Everyone knows that movie because of one special thing.
We'll get into that. We'll get into
one
that.
One special thing. Okay, yeah, go on.
But
nominated for Best Picture. Natalie Portman nominated for Best Actress.
I think she won.
Did she?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she did.
You look that up right now. I'll talk. So, I'll give the synopsis. So, Black Swan, real quick. Natalie Portman is a ballerina. And she's up-and-coming ballerina. And the movie follows her story as she's a goddamn crazy lady. Like, literally, you find out very quickly that there is something not right in her mind.
She develops a hatred for her opposite, who's played by Mila Kunis.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget the
name. Who she introduced to Darren Aronofsky, and that's how she got the role because of Natalie Portman. But so they're gonna do the ballet company or whatever, is gonna do Swan Lake, which music by Tchaikovsky or however the hell you say it, and she really wants the role of the swan, which is a double role. You have to play the white swan and the black swan. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's about that. Saying any more would be spoil. Oh, we are going to spoil it, though.
Yeah, we are.
So, she's crazy. This lady's crazy. And there's this whole mother thing. And, like, basically, you know, she's crazy. Edgar, you want to put an input on the crazy? Okay, I'll just talk about something else.
No. Okay, when associating it with insanity, it's basically she's an anorexic who's suffering a lot of envy and anxiety.
Like all ballerinas?
Well, yes,
like I just lost all of our ballerina listeners.
But during this whole aspect, she wants to get this lead role, and at first she doesn't receive it. And then she goes and talks to them, and she's all uptight and all loose because her mother's forcing her into it and making sure that she does her best because they will not allow anything to go on. And her direct, what is it? Not direct.
I don't know what he is. He's the domineering father figure in a creepy kind of way.
Yeah, because he like touches her like sexually, but not really in
intent. Really.
But not really in intent.
Yes, because he doesn't really go. You find out later. He's all like, kiss me. And then she bites him and he's all like, oh yeah, baby. Do it again.
Yes. Yeah.
But I just want to say one thing real quick. Some criticism of the movie that I feel like the movie didn't even think about. And to me, it was just like the most obvious thing in the world. So, like I was saying about how the black and white swan, it's a dual part. Like, there's this whole thing where there's Natalie Portman, and she's the perfect white swan because she's like the really pretty, goody-two-shoes ballerina, super nice, super perfect. And then there's Mila Kunis' character, who's like, she doesn't always go to practice. She's the bad girl. Like, role, you know, she's a perfect black swan. And so it was like, oh, well, she's a perfect white swan, and she's a perfect black swan. So let's make Natalie Portman both roles. I was like, wait, you just missed something here, guys. Why don't they just both play the two halves?
No. It was such like a... They explain that in the whole synopsis of the play, when they give you really early on, that they look alike. The only difference is the fact that their feathers are different, which in my mind...
One's black and one's white.
Well, of course, but that's the thing. They're supposed to look exactly alike to confuse the person.
They look the same, though. That's a whole this identity thing.
And Natalie Portman doesn't look like... Don't look enough alike in the whole aspect.
On stage, you would, especially with makeup. Why? I don't know. To me, it was just such an obvious thing that they were the two perfect halves, and why didn't they just both play the two parts? But it was like, no, we just have to have Natalie Portman play both parts.
But that's the thing. That's where the duology comes in, and that's how it's supposed to be, because they say that traditionally one person playing both roles.
Yeah, which I guess is like... Oh, it's, to me, it's just a plot hole that seems unfixable, I guess. It's just like... You know, it's like... Hey, you got your chocolate in my peanut butter. Hey, you got my peanut butter in your chocolate. Well, give me my peanut butter back. And then that's the end. It's like, wait, you missed it, guys. There was something to that, but you missed it.
No, but I have to say right off the bat, this is probably one of my... Out of all the movies that we're about to review, this is probably my least favorite. Not that it's bad. Now, Adam here is completely contrasting me, because for him, it's...
I am the black swan in this case. Or the white swan, whatever.
But the reason that I'm going to say this is because I saw the movie we're about to talk about next, The Wrestler, first. And for me, I used my knowledge from that, and I used some of my other film knowledge to kind of digest the film as it was going on, and I could pick out things. I knew the plot, I knew the twist before it was even going to occur. And it's not that it's heavy-handed, it's just I could pick it up. And do we want to spoil the ending right now?
Yes, we're spoiling it. Go ahead.
Do we want to spoil the
ending? Natalie Portman dies.
No, okay. The thing is that she confuses herself because Mila Kunis takes over the role because she's unfit for the role. She's mentally ill.
Bitch is crazy.
But in her mind, she ends up breaking a mirror and stabs Mila Kunis. Though later on, you find out that none of that happens.
She didn't stab her.
She actually stabbed herself.
I don't know how you figure that out by watching The Wrestler. Not saying you don't figure it out. I just don't understand. I saw The Wrestler, so I knew that she didn't stab her.
Because in The Wrestler, they do a similar thing.
No, they don't. There's no mind twisty, bendy stuff in The Wrestler at all.
Well, the thing is...
That's why I like Black Swan more. Not that I don't like The Wrestler. It's just Black Swan's just The Wrestler, but better, because you got crazy shit going on.
I'll explain it to you when we get there, if I can word it. It's one of those things that's just for me.
Explain it now.
Well... I don't want to get into The Wrestler.
Yes, just get in. We're comparing all his movies together.
No. I think...
Well, you do what you want, man. Okay. You want me to talk more about how Black Swan is awesome?
Gossam?
Awesome, Edgar. Okay, let me talk. Okay. Black Swan is great. All right, here's why. It's got Darren Aronofsky's style from, like, The Wrestler. It's like... It's almost documentary, but just enough to not be, and that's good, because I don't want it to be super, you know, like, it's got, like, this kind of feel to it, like, I feel like I'm out there walking behind Natalie Portman's head, which is a shot you see a lot, and, like, I don't know, you feel that coolness and, like, that sense of it, and, like, it's a really dark film, like, art direction's wonderful in that movie, like, color and lighting are super important in that movie, and, like, the conveyance of mood, and... Like, that's one thing it already has over The Wrestler, because Wrestler is, like, practically Dogma 95. There's, like, no lighting, or no, actual, it's all ambient lighting, or at least that's how it feels. Like, it doesn't feel like they actually tried with the lighting, which I don't think they did, because it was a pretty independent film. And so, like, as far as art direction goes, Black Swan one-ups The Wrestler. Like, another thing, to me, the biggest thing is, like, Wrestler is... almost just a biopic. It's just this, like, real life story, and Black Swan, you got all the crazy crap going on. Like, Natalie Portman's insane. She thinks she's a swan. It opens with a awesome ballet dream sequence. Like, I'm not a ballet person. I don't like ballet. It's just frou-frou dancing. It's weird, but this movie's great. Like, it's just like that opening scene. Remember where, like, Natalie Portman's dancing in her little costume thing, and then there's this giant like monstrous demon ballet dancer, and they're doing that dance, and like even though I don't like ballet, that dance is awesome, and like, it's trippy, and it's got the crazy stuff going on.
See, though, the
and
reason
it's just it's because of the crazy trippy stuff. Like, I feel like the form of the movie jumps out because it has to do more to tell a story. While with The Wrestler, you basically just follow a character. Well, this one you have to like show like plot elements to get you to understand and to fool the audience and things like that.
No, I know, but it's just I just picked up on the twist and I was just realizing, I'm like, okay, I'm going to wait. I'm going to see. I'm not saying I didn't really like the film. I'm just saying it wasn't as enjoyable for me because I had seen The Wrestler, which I guess most of his films pull at the heartstrings to some degree or pull at your
strings. Or the brain strings, man.
We'll get into that. But like
pie.
At your
brain stem. Strings, man.
Brain stem. No, but it's just he pulls at your strings to make you emotional and fall in, not in love, but fall very involved with the
characters. When you get involved with the characters, yeah.
And that's what I like. And I'm not saying that this one didn't do it. It's just I didn't like the way it was. And
well, that is one true thing. I will say Mickey Rourke does a better performance than Natalie Portman.
And it's just I didn't feel it as much. And it's just I was comparing it to his other work, The Wrestler, the whole time that I was watching the movie. And it's just because I had seen The Wrestler first. And I'll just say it now. I enjoyed The Wrestler. It's probably one of my all-time favorite films. And I have some comparisons.
Ram Jam.
Yeah, Ram Jam. But this film, I like the art style. I like the form. It's just I was not uncomfortable watching the film. Well, not emotionally uncomfortable. Physically uncomfortable I was, but the seat I was sitting in at the movie theater was broken.
Okay, let's not. That's a. Anyway.
No, that's just a funny story. I'm sure that some of the viewers out there will understand that.
I mean your girlfriend.
I've told this story.
Okay, before. Whatever. Anyway.
Though, I want to revisit it, which I haven't really done too well, because it's just, in my mind, I'm just,
it's I not didn't even on DVD it. Yet, is it?
Yes, it is.
It is?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, it would be by now, huh? Never mind.
And I'm like, I didn't like it as much, and it was, like I said, I was comparing it to The Wrestler because of the way that Mickey Rourke sold me as the character, and I think that's all I could really say.
Yeah, that really, that goes to, that's like the difference, I'm finally getting, to see our differences.
Yeah.
Like, I can trace it back now, like, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and how we disagreed about that, and like, now I'm seeing, like, you're more of a character guy, and of course, I'm more of a form guy. That's been established. So yeah, I respect your view, and I understand, like, I agree with you, Mickey Rourke is better, like, he does a wonderful performance in The Wrestler, and so like, yeah, I can see why you like it more.
But as for my recommend for it, I say, yeah, it's definitely a theater. I cannot
deny that. I'd say both films are theater, yeah.
Well, I'm going to give this one because I want to get into a little bit more depth at wrestling.
Well, yeah, we'll do that.
But I give this one a theater. It's not a bad movie at all. Not at all. I mean, there's a few things that you might feel uncomfortable
lesbian
for.
Lesbian scene!
Yes, that's another thing I want
to
talk about.
I know, I was going to say, we haven't gotten to that yet. The memorable moment.
But I give it that. But the most memorable scene.
But it's better because you can watch it and enjoy it if you're a dude.
Okay,
there's feel uncomfortable if you're that dude's girlfriend.
Okay, the most memorable scene in Black Swan, and this isn't the reason I'm giving it a theater at all, but it's just it's the most memorable scene, is where Natalie Portman goes to a club with Mila Kunis and she goes
in. Do you remember
in
either of their names in the movie?
No.
Neither do I
go by actors, yeah, just because I'm going to refer to them that way. It makes it less confusing.
I'm just saying I don't remember either of their names.
No, but I'm sure someone will go out and correct this.
No, no one will. We're correct about everything.
They go out to a club and they take, I think, ecstasy it is, or some sort of
they
pill.
Take some kind of drug that, yeah.
And then they get high and they're all partying and they come home to Natalie Portman's house drunk or home.
Is
and
it Natalie Portman's wife?
Yeah.
Who the hell's mom?
The mom lives there.
Where is she?
In that house.
She's oh, yeah. Yelling at him, and she's like, the lesbian don't go scene's in there. Not even real.
Yeah.
I forgot.
And then they start yelling, and then she goes in and she puts a 2x4 to the block the door out so she can't.
Not 2x4, it's like a pole.
What? It's something along those lines.
She blocks the door. Yeah, I just remembered, though, that turns out that whole lesbian scene's not even real.
No, and then
bitch is crazy.
And it's the most memorable scene, and it's really, really well made.
I'll just say. I don't know. Actually, I felt it was kind of awkward. But I understand why it's in the movie, because it's one of the themes of Black Swan is Natalie Portman's character, maturing as a woman, we'll say, and discovering herself, because in addition to the lesbian scene, there's also
a masturbation scene,
which is really weird, because Natalie Portman's, you know, getting down and funky, and then she, like, turns right, and boom, there's her mom there. Holy shit, I gotta stop doing what I'm doing. That's just creepy.
No, but it happens, and it's well made. I'm not saying it's not awkward. You mentioned it's awkward. It was awkward.
Yeah, I'm joking about how, like, yeah, lesbian scene, but actually, I don't know. I remember it being kind of really awkward, especially because I saw it with my ex.
Yeah, so I saw it with my girlfriend. It was hot. Like, it was attractive, and it was, like I said, well made.
Yeah, now that I'm single, I could probably go back and watch that movie and be like, yeah!
But it was still, it makes you uneasy, especially if you're watching it with a loved one and you don't want to be accused of things. But like I said, I give it a theater, and it's definitely one of those psychological thriller films, but do not take everything I'm saying as just a bad thing. It's just the character development in that I don't feel is as well placed.
No, yeah, I agree. One thing, my biggest complaint with movies, why I don't give it a must-see, I give it a theater as well, is Natalie Portman's character. While, like, I say, bitch is crazy, she's got, like, that complexity. She actually is basically one-dimensional. She's just this pretty, pretty girl. Like, even though she, like, tries to, like, you know, loosen herself up to be the black swan, I don't know. My impression for the whole movie was she was just this goody-two-shoes ballerina girl. And, like, she was surrounded by much more interesting characters. The weird, you know, director guy, like, he was really interesting. And one woman I really liked was the old ballerina, the, like, woman at the end of her career. I think her name was Beth in the movie. I don't remember the actress, but she was wonderful in that movie too. And, like,
yeah,
but yeah, I would definitely say, like, characters, I guess, is where the movie falls short. Like, overall, like, I love, like, all of, like, the directing, like, the form tricks, like that whole mistaken identity thing, and like the, like, Natalie Portman in the mirror, you know, and she turns around, all that, and they're just, you know, all the crazy scenes, like, really make the movie great, and, like, I don't know, worth the watch.
Using that, I'm going straight into The Wrestler,
like,
which I'll
get. Wait, I just want to say one more thing, is, like, Darren Aronofsky, like, perfect guy to make a movie about ballerinas interesting. You know, I don't like ballet one bit.
No, neither do
it's boring to me. There's probably some, you know, there's people that like it. And just, for, you know, guys that don't like it, like, see, to me, that's the thing, is, like, it's a movie that both men and women could watch, but I guess it's more men because of the lesbian scene. If they took that lesbian scene out, then it'd be, like, equal.
Well, now I'll go into The Wrestler, where it's a dark story, almost a biopic, about a wrestler who's past his prime.
Yeah, I just want to say, yeah, we say it's almost a biopic because it's very much like a biopic, except the person it's a biography of is not a real person. It's a fictional character. It's sort of based off of real people, but not any one specific person. So yeah, that's why it's almost a biopic, not actually a biopic.
Yeah, like, it's a combination. I have a wrestling background, but just to give a quick synopsis, it goes off of, it's a almost a biopic, a fictional biopic, I guess, to put it.
That's what we just said.
Well, yeah. About a wrestler by the name Ram Jam. Randy? Not Ram Jam. That's his move.
It's
Randy the Ram John
Robinson. Randy Robinson. The Ram Robinson, and his real name is Robin Randerson or something? Like,
yeah.
Randinsky. Randinsky. And Robin Randinsky is, I'm pretty sure, his real name, and then Randy the Ram Robinson.
Portrayed by Mickey Rourke, in which you see how 20 years later the toll of wrestling has dealt with him, where he's suffering, to where he has to work in between the week when he's not wrestling, and now he has to, how to put that, he has heart failure.
Oh yeah, just want to say the wrestling is not the sport wrestling, but like WWE wrestling. Like the TV, the quote unquote fake wrestling,
which you see
there. Which you find out with this movie, it's not exactly fake, although it's fake, like, who wins and who loses, but, like, these guys really, like, hurt themselves for their job.
Yeah, and that's 100% true, because everyone except for Mickey Rourke is a real wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
But, or in that movie, but it's also showing you the toll on how that does with the family life, where you see his relationship severed between, like, him and his daughter.
What family life, really?
It's his daughter.
No, I know, I mean, what family life, because it's so terrible. It's, yeah. I mean, there isn't really a family because it's dysfunctional.
And the whole thing is a very, very dark drama. but it's very emotional because you see his whole life expanding 20 years later. It's the whole thing is him and the very famous Ayatollah rekindling their match, basically having a rematch from 20 years prior. Mm-hmm. Which
because Mickey Rourke was at the end of his career, and so this seems like his way out, his way back on top.
Yeah, and
it's like kind of follows that format of a sports movie where it's like, or like Rocky or something, where it's like, I just got to do this one fight, I could get back on top, maybe I could be someone, I could be a contender instead of a nuttin', exactly. Which is Waterfront. But yeah,
but where it comes down to it is, it's based that match they're 20 year ago bout is based on the WrestleMania 3 bout between Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, the really famous one, and they would have done that themselves if Andre the Giant hadn't died like 10 years later. But it's just implying, and well, it's not implying, it's applying a whole bunch of other stuff from like Jake the Snake Roberts, how he has a severed relationship with his children, and Lex Luger's drug addictions and things like that. And the whole aspect is just very emotional because you see that it's not all fake. They are not all rich and famous. They could have been rich and famous at one point, but later in their career, they become like everyone else. Yeah, he has to
work at a deli. You know, this movie really makes me want to work at a deli. Like, Mickey Rourke's performance, the first deli scene, not the second deli scene. Like, he's having fun, man. Like, I was like, man, I want to work at a deli. It looks like fun. Like, yeah. He's just, hey, here you go. And he, like, go long. And he throws the like, potato or macaroni or whatever. And he's, like, cutting the meat. And he's doing the things. That was actually really great. That's my favorite scene in the movie. Even though, like, I don't know. Yeah, that's my favorite scene in the movie. It's, like, the deli scene. The first deli scene.
Yeah, and then it's, like, in the second deli scene with his thumb and everything when he's fed up with the whole working there and all that stuff. But what I like is the way that they interpret wrestling to just not even be really a side story. It's just there to keep you reminded that he wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm. That was his calling. It's what he actually loved to do. And that,
and it comes like through at thing. The end.
Yeah. Like, what I love about this movie was, like, I thought it would kind of follow, like, Rocky and things like that, which it in a way does, but it's like, boom, right off the bat, heart attack. You can't wrestle anymore. So I was like, oh, shit. This isn't a wrestling movie. Like,
no.
For most of the movie, you know, it's just there's, like, the one in the beginning and then the one at the end. So, like, you know, fucking has a heart attack. And, like, you know, that, like, it's not about wrestling. And yet it is also, but it's, yeah.
And then he falls in love with a stripper.
Mm-hmm.
Who's
gorgeous.
Yeah, it's Marissa Tomei.
Yeah.
Who held up very well over the years. Though, that said, you see how he just can't hold anything together. He's completely moving around. He's full of emotion. And the strongest parts of the film is where you see how much of the passion, as Adam had already stated, about his love for the sport. You see him get the hits of a gigantic fluorescent light bulb. You see him get you see how he's actually taking steroids.
He means a staple gun.
Well, yeah.
You said a gun stapled like a gun, and then they like staple the gun to. No, like, you mean staple gun stapling him.
Yes. Well, yeah, understood what I meant. And it ends on a very bittersweet note where he comes into the wrestling ring and he has already had his first heart attack, and they told him he can't do anymore. He has to be very careful with what he does. And they want him to retire. Well, he ends up going with the match with the Ayatollah, and he does his very
Apollo
famous...
Creed? Wait, no, Ayatollah.
Yeah. He ends up doing his signature move.
The Ram Jam!
The Ram Jam, where it's just a flying headbutt, for those of you who know, and for those of you who don't, he hops onto the top rope.
Not
and
a flying headbutt, it's elbows.
Is it an elbow?
Technically, I don't really remember, because the one time you see it, like, it's far away, and then, like, at the very end, you don't see him land. Because he's always hitting his elbows, so I thought it's something with the elbows.
Well,
whatever it is.
It's either a flying
It's a ram jam.
Or a flying elbow. But nonetheless, he does it, and it ends on a very bittersweet note, because you see how his hearing's going out during the match, and how his heart is racing. Or it's implied that it is, because of the way that the sound effect and the cues are there.
Yeah.
And he goes up to the top rope, and he does his move.
No, I think there is a heartbeat sound, I think.
Yeah. And
I think. I don't remember.
He just jumps off, and he's about to land, and it
cuts. But you don't see it. Yeah, that's the end.
And it's the thing is, it's sort
of open-ended, but it's sort of more implied that he dies. I kind of.
It's implied that he either died after the match.
Yeah.
Which would then
or lead just it. Went on to success, happy ever after.
But if he died at the end of the match, then it's implying that he followed what happened to a real wrestler back in 1999, when he was pretending to be the Blue Blazer, Owen Hart, I think was his name, and he during an event actually got killed because it went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He fell off, and he actually broke his neck, I think, and he died during a pay-per-view event, so they couldn't just cut it off for those.
Oh snap! Paid. Yeah.
And they had to continue. And like I said, it could have been like that. They could have been implying that. But they used real people's lives of real wrestlers.
Well, yeah, I think, like, it doesn't... Or, I mean, it's good that it ended there because, like, that's where the story ends. You know, I don't think you need to show what happens afterwards. Like, that's really his moment. You know, yeah. Like, where, like, after going through so much trouble, he's finally, you know, he's just like, fuck it, I'm just going to wrestle again. And, you know, and he does his signature move, and that's where the story ends. And, like, that's, you know, his story. So, like, if he dies or not is not necessarily important.
Yeah, it's him doing what he loved. It's a bittersweet ending.
Yeah.
And that's what I enjoyed the most. Now, this film, as you already stated, this is a theater for you. Now, for me, I like to bounce around between a must-see and a theater. For me, it's one of my favorite films of all time. Though, for you, it's just... Those who are wrestling fans, I give it a must-see, but for
if you're a wrestling fan, then it's definitely, like, must-see. I don't even know anything about wrestling, but I could just tell, like, it really does service to it. Like, It made me respect wrestling more, and I'm still not really a wrestling person, but, like, just seeing this movie made me respect it.
Yeah, and for those of you who haven't, I give it a theater, because it's not really one of those movies that will open up your mind. It's... Like Black Swan, it really depends on what you prefer.
It's exactly like that. Aronofsky is making movies of things I would not find actually normally enjoyable. Like, I'd never really watch ballet, just like I wouldn't really enjoy watching a wrestling match. But these movies are still very interesting.
Yeah, they really are. And you don't even have to be a fan, which is why I like them both.
Yeah.
So I give this, for an overall audience, a theater.
I just give it a theater. Because, like, Mickey Rourke is great. You know, he does that, like, the one crying scene. That was good stuff.
Yeah.
And just, like, overall, I don't know, he is Randy the Ram.
Well, it's usually said that it kind of mirrors his own life.
Yeah, because that is Mickey Rourke's comeback film, because, like, a lot of other actors, like Robert Downey Jr. or something, you know, he went into drugs and things like that, and so, like, his career went... And this movie was, like, you know, his... comeback movie, and you know, it's a comeback movie about an actor, or I mean about a guy, and like, you know, I guess that's why it worked so perfectly. Probably, like, it resonated within Mickey Rourke's own, like, you know, person, like hey, this movie, I can understand this movie because of his own personal life.
Now,
and then he went on to go to great movies like Iron Man 2 and The Expendables.
I'll say that this is probably going to be the movie he's going to be remembered for the most.
This is the thing that I Iron Man 2, not that great of a film, but I liked Mickey Rourke in it.
Yeah, he's not bad. Yeah, it's just overall as a film, it's not...
Yeah, overall as a film. Like, there are actually a lot. Robert Downey Jr. I like. Sam Rockwell's in it. I like him.
But like I said, it's like overall as a film, it's not a good film, but you could pick things that you like.
Yeah, and Don Cheadle is in that. I like him too. I like all the actors in that movie. How come the movie wasn't so good,
overall?
You know why? It's called form. Form and story, Edgar.
We'll get into
those
that.
Two other legs of my tripod.
Okay. No, but we're... I just have to say this now because we mentioned the rug munching scene. There's actually...
Nice way to put it there. Classy stuff.
Okay. The lesbian scene. We didn't specify what happened, but there's...
Well, now you did specify what happened.
Now we just lost all of our audience.
Mm-hmm.
No,
not that we had any.
In this one, there's actually a sex scene too. In between.
I forgot because it's not with
Marissa Tomei.
Marissa Tomei. It's with just some random, like, white trash girl.
Yeah, he snorts cocaine.
That was awkward, but it was supposed to be awkward.
Yeah, it's just supposed to show you that he isn't changing. He changes, but then he kind of.
That's one thing I love about this movie is Mickey Rourke and his daughter. They don't have a happy ending.
No.
Mickey Rourke fucks up and the daughter's like, I don't want to see you ever again. And that's that. Like, you know, they don't have some bullshit heartwarming ending. Like,
he even loses up, and that's Marissa Tomei. Marissa Tomei runs to the
Well, you don't necessarily know if he loses them, depending on if he dies or not.
Well, I think if he lives,
he'd still be with her.
But she says, if you go out there, I don't want to, you know.
Yeah, she said that. She's just saying that so he doesn't go out there. She ran to watch.
True. And one thing that I just have to claim that's unrealistic, the pricing that they were putting on the tickets, unless it was an independent circuit, it would not be that cheap.
It is independent circuit, though.
Well, it's implied it's independent.
Yeah, that's what all the wrestlers were based off of. Like, they were, the actual, like, all the wrestlers in there were, what do you call it, like, independent washed-up wrestlers. Like, no, just the circuit. Movie, all the wrestling scenes in the movie were actual wrestling events that they happened to film at, and, like, yeah. They were indie, they're not, like, WWE and all that, they were just, you know.
But see, WWE drafts from independent circuits, but they own most independent circuits. If not them, then their competition league.
Well, I'm just saying, TNA. I saw the making of thingy on the wrestler DVD, and that's what it was saying.
Watched it a long time ago.
Yeah, they were saying they were just completely independent, so I would assume the movie is following suit.
Yeah, so that's the understanding. I guess that's how I understand it, but it's just... Like you said, it just gives you a whole new perspective and a new respect for just the whole sport as ballet with Black Swan. Mm-hmm. Now, what film do you want to talk about next?
Well, we have to sum up these ones quick because we're already at the hour mark. We haven't even gotten to Pie in the Fountain. So I think let's just tackle them both at the same time, which are Darren Aronofsky's two earliest films, Pie being his first, which was funded completely by $100 donations from like friends and family. And it was a cheap-ass, low-budget movie, black and white, but actually really effective. Like, one thing, Darren Aronofsky films, besides The Wrestler, like, lighting and color are super, super important. Like, Pie, that is black and white. Like, the blackest of black and white. Like, there's almost no gray in that movie. Like, it's seriously black and white. You know what I'm saying? There is gray. It's just, it's super high contrast, unlike Following or other... black and white movie,
which is something I wanted to compare it to. Just to give a quick synopsis on Pie, how would you go? It's a
movie about a mathematician,
a mathematician who has very low social skills, who is trying to find a pattern in not only in nature but in stock market, because he sees that everything has its way and it goes all around the golden rectangle. For those of you who don't know, go take a geometry class. But the thing is, he's being stalked down by a company, and how would you describe the other one?
And Jews. Not Jews in general, but like, that reminds me of the Coen brothers so much, because they got this weird Jewish stuff going on. That's something the Coen brothers have a lot. Like, if you watch Big Lebowski or Serious Man, you get this kind of thing. But like, because the Jews are looking for this secret code, supposedly, in the Bible that like is...
This is
God's name, God's true name. Yeah, this is in Pi, that like is holds to God's true name, and then this the company, you know, is obviously looking for the same thing. Oh yeah, and the guy, the main character's name in Pi, his last name's Cohen. I found that funny. I was like, oh, Cohen brothers, his name's Cohen. Anyway, they're looking obviously like the same thing, something to predict the stock market so they can make money. So lost my train of thought.
He's trying to come up with a pattern.
What happens is he's got a big computer, supercomputer and all that, and
for 1998.
Yeah, this is 1998, so you know, computer from then. But the computer ends up breaking, and like it prints out some like predictions of the stock market that were apparently really low and really shitty. Or I mean, what he thought was really shitty, like they were bad predictions, and then like all of a sudden it just printed a random string of numbers. And like he thought it was just the computer breaking, so he threw that those set of numbers away. And like, but apparently, the number was close to 216, which apparently is the exact same number that the Jews were looking for. And then his professor, who what do you call it? He was like all washed up because he was trying to figure out pi, which of course he couldn't.
Which he pretty much solved with a Go board, which we'll go into later.
And so like that number was also 216 digits, so he's looking for this magical 216 digit number, and essentially he doesn't find it. And because the movie's not actually about that number, it's about him. It's about obsession, which is something Darren Aronofsky goes into a lot. Like, that's one of the things we didn't really talk about. We're running out of time to talk about that because we still got to get to the fountain. Is Darren Aronofsky, one of his, like, signature things is obsession. Be it a drug addiction or, like, in Black Swan, like, addiction to ballet or, like, a craft. Or in Pi, like, addiction to, like, just the number and finding patterns. And Fountain is, I guess this is a good way to segue into the Fountain, is an obsession with death and not wanting to die.
Now, let me give that synopsis as well. It's basically a brain surgeon who is trying to come up with a way to reduce a hormonal growth in a tumor, a brain tumor specifically. And to spoil it,
his girlfriend.
It's for his wife, isn't it?
Wife, I mean, yes. Not girlfriend. Wife.
He's trying to solve it for his wife who keeps suffering these seizures, or at least that's how it's explained.
Yeah.
And in the film, it goes through three different angles of it. It goes through what is
there are three different stories, and it's all interconnected.
Yeah, what's happening in reality, which is Hugh Jackman's reality.
And Hugh Jackman's the brain surgeon. That's the reality.
And then it goes to the story where she wrote The Fountain, in which...
Which is this book that the wife is writing, and it takes place in, like, 16th century Spain or whatever.
Which eerily parallels. And the last one where it's him...
Which, this one, like, it's not necessarily connected in any way. It's just sort of, like, allegorical.
Is.
Or you could say that maybe it's in Hugh Jackman's character's head. No, like, there really isn't any actual connection, like, except the thing at the end with Hugh Jackman writing the story. But, like, I don't know. To me, like, it's just this meta story that really just doesn't take place anywhere. It's just its own story that's just connected.
But before we go, let me explain it. It's... Hugh Jackman with a shaved head being a monk who's trying to resurrect a tree.
Well, I don't know if he's necessarily a monk. He's just a...
Well, he's dressed like a monk. He's monk-like.
Yeah. Okay.
And not a...
He's a monkey?
The whole
no.
thing, but he's trying to revive
this
tree.
He's in this snow globe with a big tree in it, and he's flying through space, and he's going to this emission nebula.
Where it's a dying star.
A emission nebula that was created from a dying star.
And it's supposed to be the underworld for the Mayans.
Mm-hmm. Which relates to the Spanish story that... Yeah.
Which explains to the reality of what she was doing.
Yeah.
What his wife was writing. And the whole thing, where it comes down to that, is his obsession with death, how he cannot accept the fact that she's dead. And no
and
matter
himself,
what...
That and himself. That comes into play later, and it actually is throughout the whole thing, that Hugh Jackman, while like... is immediately obvious that he's afraid of his wife dying, is also incredibly afraid of his own death. And, like, that's something you don't really figure out till the very end of the movie where, you know, he's like, I'm going to die too.
Yeah.
And so this movie, yeah, it's about death. And I would say this movie maybe is my favorite Aronofsky film, that or Black Swan. Like, I like the way Black Swan was directed more, but I love the story of Fountain so much more.
Now... just to get in a little bit more, while he's just trying to accept death himself, I felt it to be humorous at some points because he's obviously in so much denial. And I found it not humorous as in laugh out loud funny, but humorous in the fact that we all do it. We all try to think of ourselves as immortal. And this movie basically cements the thought that, you know... we're only temporary.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you that perspective. And who else to do it but, you know, the one who is supposed to play an immortal being in a different film.
Because he's Wolverine, man. I expected him to take out the claws and start chopping the brain surgery with his adamantium.
Yeah.
Not really. Actually, I just realized we should just keep going and relax. I'll cut out the news if we go over, which we are.
All right.
But anyway.
And I'm going to say maybe not my... favorite, but it's definitely, I like it more than I did Pi. And only because Pi, the camera angles at times, while it was really clever.
It's very experimental.
Yeah, it's like, it was wobbling around a lot, and it was...
Because they had this weird thingy that attached to the main guy's body, and so it, like, followed him in a weird way.
But not
like, effective at times when they're getting in those trippy, crazy moments. But other times it just came out kind of awkwardly. You're like, why is the camera doing this?
He's tripping because he stared at the sun.
Yeah. My mother told me to never stare at the sun. So one time when I was six, I did. Blah, 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 blah. Everything became clear and blah, blah, blah. I like pie, though.
No, I'm not saying I didn't like it.
Like, Aronofsky... See, this is why we're devoting a day to him, just like with Christopher Nolan, is him and Christopher Nolan, and there are others, are, like, our generation's great directors, I think. Like, you know, you just wait. These guys, you know, if not already ingrained in history, will soon be, because they're still going around, they're still making movies, and they're, you know, I like talking about them because they're contemporary, they're our generation. You know, like Spielberg, I love Spielberg so much, but he's not my generation. He's before.
Yeah, he was.
But Christopher Nolan and Aronofsky are our generation, and they're still making movies right now, and they're the guys really making the great movies of our generation, the stuff that's really going to be remembered.
Some of them.
I feel like we're concluding now, but we're not. Not necessarily. Let's keep talking about Pie in the Fountain.
But just going back to Pie real quick, there's this whole plot where he keeps searching for his brain, or he sees a brain.
Mm-hmm.
In random spots. He sees...
In the subway, and then subway, in the sink. And then the sink. I think that's it.
Yeah, he only sees it twice, but you realize it's his own brain, and he pokes at it. And the more he pokes at it, the more he has his own headaches, because as we were joking about, he stared at the sun when he was six because his mom never told him to, because he wanted to be enlightened, and he kept staring and staring until he basically ate out part of his retina.
I don't know. I don't think this thing happens, but I love that idea of him. Like, that's so symbolic and obvious, but great. Like, staring into the sun. Like, you know, of course, you just go blind. That's what happens. Just burn your eyes out. But, no, he gets clarity and, like, something. Maybe this is a real thing. Like, if you stare in the sun long enough. I don't know. I don't know anyone who's done that.
But he's also, like, crazy.
Like, yeah. He gets, like, weird headaches and stuff. Like, there's something wrong with his head. But he's like, also... not in, like, Natalie... Well, actually, yeah, in, like, Natalie Portman's sense, but...
Well, it's different. We'll compare
them. We'll talk about that in a bit, if we get to it.
He's crazy good when it comes to math.
Mm-hmm. He, like, there's this little Chinese girl talking to him, having him add numbers up, and he can do crazy, like, you know, triple-digit multiplication and all that.
Yes, and he always
This should be a mathematician's favorite film.
It could be up there. And then...
Like, just... Never mind.
And then now he kept comparing it to Following... Which is Nolan's first film. If you go back to that episode, you'll
understand. They're both their first film. They're both black and white.
They're both roughly the same length.
Yeah, except Pi is better.
Pi is considerably
better. But I like Christopher Nolan more, but I don't want to get into this battle.
We'll get into it.
I know, you probably like Aronofsky more.
I like his oeuvre. But then again, I haven't seen all of Nolan's. I need to watch more of Nolan to compare it.
Well, you've seen his best films. Oh, you haven't seen Prestige, huh?
No.
That's a good one. You'll like that one.
Which...
I think that'll probably be your favorite film besides Memento.
Probably.
Because I think it's more to your kind of dealio with characters. Because I remember... Oh, you know who's in that?
Hugh Jackman. And I think that one was released the same year as The Fountain.
Was it really?
I think so.
I think Prestige was later. Maybe by a little... I don't know. They probably filmed during the same time.
But where I was going at is... I was comparing the two and I was... Darren Aronofsky, you see his talent. You see where he could be good at. While Nolan, during that film, you saw his strengths.
You saw, like, potential, but you didn't really see what was coming after that.
Yeah, but
like, yeah.
With Darren Aronofsky, it was, like, right off the bat, you could see
See his style. Like, Darren Aronofsky's got this, I was talking about before, almost documentary style, except not. Especially Fountain actually is kind of different from all of his other films. But, like, I don't know, he loves these, like, developing shots... Where, like, it basically just follows the character, like, the main character, and, you know, usually it's from behind the character walking, but in Pi there's, like, a lot of front stuff. And, I don't know, you get his style right off the bat with Pi, which you see throughout the rest of his movies.
Well, going off what you were saying, it's just the character developed really well, too, which is something I liked. And that's not something that happened in Nolan's first film.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the character was kind of bland the whole time, and it's just being told. But in this one, I saw so much potential, and I saw so much going on. And I knew his work, but I was, like, saying, nope, how did he get to The Wrestler? Let's see what he did in between. And the one movie that we haven't discussed, which will get its own episode later, is
Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
Another movie about obsessions, and, of course, Requiem for a Dream about drugs.
And it's, well, I like the way, because the character developments and the way that the story kept implementing, I questioned how much of this is real. How much of what he actually did here is even based in reality? As in, is the Hebrew language fully listed as math, as they put it there?
Which it is.
And see,
but I don't know if there's this whole secret code thing. There probably is some crazy cult doing that, though.
Yeah, so that's why I was questioning. It's like, because it was...
But yeah, it felt real. Like, you felt like this was a real thing happening in this world, kind of. Certain parts, no, but...
I kept questioning them during the whole film. What does he do? How does he get his money?
That's true. Like, he doesn't have a job. They don't explain that. How does he live in that place?
Yet he has his apartment
with maybe his landlady is just really a pushover. Like, she says, like, you're out of here. And then nothing ever happens after that.
But
she, like, doesn't evict him, even though she said she wants him out. No. So I think, yeah, maybe that's how I'm going to explain it in my head. It's just, you know what? Maybe, you know, maybe he gets a little something on the side with the landlady.
No, I don't.
I don't want to accept that. You don't get anything on the side, this guy.
There's a girl who likes him the whole time, and she keeps trying to come up with him and talk to him. And nope.
Pushes her away. Yeah, because he's such a, like, anti-social misanthrope.
Though, the other thing I have to mention is where it comes, how was I going to put this? At the very end, where he has his last big crucial moment, because the whole time you see him combat with his headaches and how he's angering and just fighting, and he just keeps having these seizures and these fits.
Mm-hmm.
What he does is he shaves his head towards the end, and to reveal this huge chromosome-like scab, I want to say. Or
it's
scar.
Not a scab. It's like this weird protrusion. It's like a growth.
And
it's coming out, not going in his head.
It's coming out.
Yeah.
And what he does is right there, earlier in the movie, he draws a spiral because it's supposed to be from the golden rectangle. But and this time, instead of going with the math, he pulls up a power drill.
He pulls up a power drill and just drills his head. Well, you know what? That's like drawing a spiral. Think about it. A drill. You know.
Yeah, he's just going to scramble his brain. Or got brainwashed.
Yeah, there was a brain in his sink and he was hitting it. He made that weird noise.
He really did.
That was one of that's like the only like scene where he like isn't that good of an actor. He actually does a good job. Although he's basically a one-dimensional character, and like his character arc is like at the very end. And, you know, actually, this is one thing I just want to say. What I said about Pi before, how it's, like, sort of about obsession and how he's supposed to realize, like, the numbers aren't necessarily important, but it's your life and what you do with it and how you spend your time, you know. And, like, you know, he stops pursuing that 216 number, that digit, and, you know, just is happy. They don't... He didn't necessarily go through that arc. That could have just been brain damage. He didn't necessarily come to that realization because
he
takes the drill, he drills himself in the head, boom, we see him later and he's happy in the park. What was all the stuff that's happening to him? Like, the viewer understands. Like, I see, like, you know, oh, the number's not important. You know, he's ruining his life in pursuit of something that, you know, he really shouldn't be wasting his time on. But now that I think about it, the character not necessarily doesn't realize that. I think that was the intention, but just as a side note, nitpicking, if you really think about it, it doesn't necessarily come to that realization.
No.
He just drills himself in the head and then it's like, well, I can't do math anymore.
No, but if you remember the little Asian girl, the only friend he really has other than the Indian girl who has the hots for him.
Mm-hmm.
She tells him, well, she goes, okay, what's this number times this number?
I don't know. Shit, man. Stop asking these questions.
Shows you that he's not as obsessed with mathematics, because the whole film, he's like, everything has a formula. Mm-hmm. He wants everything to have a proof, something to be exact.
Oh, I got a good segue to get back to the fountain. Now, while, you know, Cohen, character of Pi, doesn't really come to this realization, Hugh Jackman character, I mean, well, the Pi character doesn't necessarily come to this realization, but Hugh Jackman character does, and it's perfectly seen. You can tell that, oh, yeah, I understand.
Well, I was going to go to that.
Yeah.
And
like my segue, that was a good one.
That was. Now, she keeps talking about how the Mayans were risen up by the original father having
We're talking about the fountain now, by the way, not pie. There's no Mayans in the pie.
About how a tree comes out from him. Mm-hmm. And it's clever because at the very end, you see him with... You see her or her image give him a plucked seed. I can't remember what that thing's called.
Yeah.
But
a little bab.
A barb?
A barb.
Barb.
But it's not a barb. But, you know, but it's a prickly little thing.
Yeah. If you guys know what it is, just tell us. Mm-hmm. But she gives him the barb, and he goes, and he's walking in the snow. And he just looks down. He scrapes off the snow, and he's at her grave.
Mm-hmm.
And he...
Like, boom, right there, you already know he's accepted her death. She's dead. And there he is, not, like, you know, screaming. He's there, and he understands, and the story comes full circle. Okay, go on.
And then he digs a hole into her grave, and he puts the little barb there, and he seeds it up there. Because he's basically saying that from there, from that barb, life will grow.
Yeah.
And it's just to show you that from death, life can still go on.
Or death life can continue. As an act of creation. That's what they say in the movie. That's what she says herself. And that you can tell that, like, that's what kind of her wish, you know, to, you know, that Hugh Jackman fulfills. It's like planting a seed where her grave is, which is what she said happened to the one mind dude or whatever.
Yeah. Father. And it goes full circle, and I really enjoyed that. It was a really emotional scene.
You know, one other thing I really love that movie is its music, which is playing right now. But we can't hear it. But it is beautiful.
Okay, well, just to go on the music thing, something that we didn't talk about last week. Just
last
one little
week.
Thing. On the Gladiator. You can cut this out.
Oh, just, Hans Zimmer?
Yeah. When it came down to the Gladiator, the whole freaking Pirates of the Caribbean music.
I know, like, it won, I think. Yeah, Hans Zimmer won. It was him and one woman, and the woman didn't get it because you can't have the Oscar rules at the time. There was no co-composer thing. But anyway, he won for that movie, and I was like, that movie had terrible music. It sounded like Pirates of the Caribbean, which I like Pirates of the Caribbean music, but I mean, it sounded like it, and it wasn't very good, and it wasn't even in most of the movie. Like, there wasn't much, like, good music in that movie.
It didn't fit it.
Yeah.
It didn't fit the tone of this, what you mean.
I know Pirates of the Caribbean came after Gladiator.
It's the same
music. And it's the same guy. I'm just saying that Gladiator's music actually isn't that good, but we're off topic.
I know, I just wanted
back
to bring
to the
that
movie
up
with good music.
Talking about the music.
Fountain. Like I was saying, color's great. One thing is the directing, like, is actually really different. Like, it's less Aronofsky than the other ones, and, like, I still like it. But that's what I was saying is I like Black Swan's form more because it's got more of that style. While Fountain is actually pretty much standard. Like, the only thing that totally, like, branches out and is crazy is just the stuff that's actually happening. You know, with the whole meditating tree flying through space. Like, people who haven't seen this movie are going to be like, what the hell are they talking about? I got to see this. Yeah, go see it, because it's got crazy stuff.
Well, I don't know how much more I can say, because I don't really want to go into so much and just give every little bit of the movie detail.
I know. We're trying to tackle something too big, and that's an entire director's career.
So,
but we're basically just reminiscing about his good movies,
oh,
besides the big one.
I do have to say, though, during that whole film, it was actually pulling at my heartstrings because recently I didn't have a death, but I had a dream about my girlfriend dying in a horrible accident, and it was giving me that kind of closure.
Mm-hmm. Hitting you in your weak spots, Eddie.
Yeah, and it was just very strongly driven. I felt like it was perfectly timed because it was a good movie. It was actually... It was just pulling at the heartstrings the whole time. I couldn't stop. I was just... I kept thinking of her, and the whole time I just wanted to, like, kind of pick up my phone and call her and just go, like, you need to watch this movie.
Which you did. You texted during the damn movie, Edgar.
Not during.
Actually, we paused it, though.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
But.
So, Edgar, which one would you say is your favorite besides The Wrestler?
That's a
tough
one.
I know The Wrestler is your favorite, so, but not that
one. I would have to say it's probably The Fountain. Because The Fountain was just very strongly emotional, and it helped me accept death as it is, because it's something you can't avoid. As best put by, I think it was Benjamin Franklin, only two things are certain in life.
No, that's Mark Twain.
Is it Mark Twain?
I think it better. I'm pretty sure it's Mark Twain.
Okay.
Death and taxes.
Death and taxes.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
That's Mark Twain.
I'm gonna look this up.
but
as nonetheless, the whole quote is just nothing is certain except for death and taxes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I like Woody Allen's quote is, it's not that I'm afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Very true.
Yes. And yeah, I'm gonna say I can't decide between Fountain or Black Swan. No, I'm gonna say Fountain 2. And actually, I will give that one a must-see just because it's a unique film about a subject matter not dealt with in the way this movie deals with it.
It's basically Enlightenment.
It's basically a lot of different things. I don't know. It's just got so much going for it. Like, despite it not actually being form-wise, like, truly spectacular, as opposed to, like, Black Swan, like, it's still
it was the Benjamin story. And Franklin.
It really?
Yeah.
Then what did Mark Twain say?
I don't know. Keep going, though.
Are you sure it's Ben Franklin?
Yes.
All right, I believe your damn iPhone. But Mark Twain said something, okay?
Keep going. It deals with death in a certain way that other films don't deal with.
Yeah.
As in, it gives you that... I guess this one actually gives you closure, is the thing. It lets you know that it's okay. While other movies, the way that they kind of...
brush it aside or... yeah. Deny it. Well, that's sort of human nature to do that. No. And this movie just, you know, it shoves it in your face. It's just like, here you go. And I don't know. I love the way that, like, it feels. And, like, I just love the way the movie treats death. It's, like, with its symbolism through, like, the tree and this stuff and the flying through the space, it, like, it gives death this ever-present feeling. Like, it's there while not being in any specific place. Although, I guess in the symbolism, it sort of is in a specific place. And, like, but, I mean... with this whole, I love the three-tiered story system that is all one story, because, like, the way the human mind works, when you're watching this movie, you connect it all, and so, like, you're watching one story, and the effects of that story are present in a different story, you know, with, like, the brain surgeon, Hugh Jackman, and, like, you get that ominous, symbolic death feeling in your normal story, where without, like, the crazy, you know, Tai Chi floating tree and space stuff, but you still get that feeling in the regular, you know, surgeon story. And, like, the Spanish story, you know, helps both also as well.
Helps explain.
Yeah.
Now,
and so I guess because of that, yeah, it's incredibly interesting and well written. And Aronofsky, I'm pretty sure he wrote it.
Well, now, since you've already given your recommend, which is a
must see. Now, so I guess, obviously, because I say it's a must-see, it is the best one out of all of the ones I've seen.
Now, what would you give Pi?
Well, Pi has a lot going for it, but it also has some shortcomings. Just, like, technically, you know, that has some hiccups, and, you know, it's an indie movie, and so the acting isn't perfect, you know, and I like the black and white, the use of it, but, yeah, I just give it a wait for home, or watch it at home. Actually, no, I'll give it a theater. Why not? I think it's worth it.
Now, as for me, going off what you were saying for The Fountain, it was really well made, and it let me realize, you know, nothing is permanent.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's going to die. The tree, the symbolic tree.
That's dies, you know, itself. I love stories about mortality. Sorry to interrupt. It's just that's also why I love Up, which we will get to someday.
We will. And it's definitely one of those films that I will revisit again, especially when something bad happens to me again like that, because you know the story, but our listeners don't. Last year, I
had... Wait, what was this about keeping personal life out of it when I was talking before, man? I'm just kidding. Go on.
Last year, I had three deaths of people close to me. Well, two very close to me, one close to someone else, and I attended the funerals, and it was difficult for me to accept, especially since these were the first times I ever really dealt with death, other mm-hmm. than a dead dog.
Dead dog can be effective. Don't underplay that.
No, it's not that. Important. It's just, like, it's the first time, because as close as I was to the dog, these people were closer to me.
Yeah.
So it was even harder for me to swallow it, and they all happened in a very close range within about 3 months. And this movie let me get some of that closure out. Even though it's a little belated, it's been almost a year.
One thing I just want to say about this movie is it deals with death, but not in an overtly religious sense.
No.
Like, it's not like God's the answer or they're all in heaven now, so be happy. It's not like that at all.
No, it's not.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, as an atheist, I really give this movie credit for is, like, even if, you know, even if you are religious, you can still watch this and still appreciate it. I'm just saying, as an atheist, I don't feel like this movie is shoving God or any kind of religion down my throat, but it deals with death. So, like, that's something, you know, really important.
So, going off with that, I don't give it a must-see, because I know there's people out there who won't like the artistic style, but I do give strong, like, a theater. I can't give it any lower than that, because the movie is definitely worth a viewing. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a theater. And where it comes down to Pi, this one's more difficult for me to go, because I enjoyed a lot of it, but there were parts that I didn't. And where it comes down to me not liking it is it felt a little long because of some of the slower pacing.
Mm-hmm. Even though the wrestler's got slower pacing. But anyway, go on.
But see, the wrestler, I could involve myself with the character. Yeah, and this okay, one, the character had a lesser arc. And as you were mentioning, but was it an enjoyable film? Yes. If you like indie types of films, then you'll definitely love this one. Mm-hmm. And if you enjoy black and white films, especially, you know, directional debuts, to see how a director went mm-hmm. from one way to another, this is also a great film to see. I give it a much higher review than I did for The Following, but maybe not as high as the others, and I give this one a matinee.
Matinee?
Yes.
Yeah, actually, I think I will take it down from theater. Matinee makes more sense. Yeah, I wouldn't want to pay the full price. Yeah, matinee works.
Yeah,
it's still worth like the theater, but not like the full price. But Fountain, I give it a must see. Although, like, I understand people probably can't get past the whole Hugh Jackman's bald and running around with the tree thing. Like, that's just, you know, that's sad that you don't get it. But I guess I can understand people aren't as artsy as I am.
But like I said, I enjoyed the film, yeah. And I give it a theater for all our viewers out there, and I give Pi the matinee.
Mm-hmm. And then you give Wrestler Must See and Black Swan Theater.
No, I gave the Wrestler a theater.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, do you want to say your scores again?
Wrestler Theater, Black Swan Theater.
Okay. Well,
I think good stuff. Good stuff. Thank you, Aronofsky, for allowing us to use your music for this movie. I'm just kidding. You didn't allow anything. But we gave him a good rap, okay? You know, when the music company sues us because we were selling this on the DVD collection. Aronofsky, we got your back, bro. Why don't you get ours? Okay. That's it for the Film Pod. You can always contact me at filmyfilm@mail.com and follow me on Twitter at filmyfilmblog. You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our RSS feed. You can do that with iTunes as well. We're on iTunes, baby. Just search the Film Pod. Comment, subscribe, do all that stuff, rate it. I don't think there is a rating thing, but tell your friends, scream it at children. Edgar, to you.
And you can follow me on Twitter at EdgarTacoRam. And please, when you go onto iTunes and try to download us, leave us a review. Let people know that we're there, because that helps us rise up to the charts, and that helps people realize that we exist. And remember, it's Film Pod with 1D, not 2. There's a German one that has a similar name.
Yeah, there's a weird-ass German one, Film Pod today.
And you can follow me on Tumblr as well, where me and my girlfriend have reviews at couplescut@tumblr.com.
I'll leave it. That's good. Thanks for listening.
He's actually good in.
Yeah.
But it's like, if maybe even Get Smart, because that looks like his type of
comedy.
No, that
looks terrible.
It looked better than his competition, The Love Guru.
What? Wait.
The competition,
it doesn't matter if it's better than its competition. The poop better than other, you know, that poop shinier than the other poop. Both poop. That'll make it better.
Well, I don't know. I heard good things of it.
I don't know.
And there's, like I said, there's certain